I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Hello, I'm Lale Arakoglu, and this is a brand new episode of Women Who Travel. At the end of last year, Shayna Habib talked at length about avoiding obsessive adherence to bucket lists and encouraged us all to be more intentional and thoughtful with our travels. It got us thinking about a trend that we talk a lot about at Condé Nast Traveller, slow travel. So over the next few months, we'll be digging into what that term actually means and how to incorporate that mindset into the way we see and experience the world.
For me, slow travel is really walking. And it's one of the ways I really love to see a country is to walk across it, because I think by doing that, you smell it, you feel it under your feet, you have the wind or the cold or the sun on your face, and it gives you an entirely new depth to what you're experiencing.
Author and BBC presenter Alice Morrison is talking to me from the High Atlas Mountains, what she dubs the Switzerland of Morocco.
I really wanted to do something. I wanted to move. I wanted to cross something, you know.
Were you always a big walker?
All human beings, if you think about it, unless we're differently abled, are big walkers. I mean, you know, once we emerged from the primordial swamp and stood on our two legs, that's the first thing we did. We migrated. It was almost immediate. So I do think that that kind of desire to move is absolutely genetically programmed within it.
Alice walked across Morocco from the Sahara to the Atlas Mountains in three parts, keeping a diary and writing notes along the way, which led to her book, Walking with Nomads.
The reason I called my book Walking with Nomads was I was walking with two people who were nomads, and we met many nomads along the way. My first stage of this three-stage journey was to walk from Ouarzazate to a place called Ouedjibika, which is just south of Tantan on the Atlantic coast. The first leg along the Drau River was absolutely fantastic. I found a lost city. I found tombs of the giants. There were these spaceship-like structures in the middle of the desert on top of the cliffs. There are funerary monuments. I unearthed shards of fossilized ostrich eggs from when there used to be ostriches roaming in the Sahara. I mean, it really was like Indiana Jones for girls. We kept finding things, which was fantastic and rather unexpected, actually. And then when I finished that leg, I wanted to walk from the Mediterranean to Mauritania. So I then did a further two legs, one a Sahara leg from where we'd finished the first expedition to Gergerat on the Mauritanian border. And then the very last one, I had to go up north and go from Nador down back to Ouarzazate to a very triumphant ending in Ouarzazate itself.
Tell me a little bit more about the landscape. Was there a change of scenery as you went through each phase of this journey?
There really was. I mean, the landscape was soul expanding. That's the only way to describe it. We'd walk for days sometimes and not see anyone. And sometimes in the Sahara, you'd walk for days and not see anything. You were walking on flat sand in the wind. And you could see the curvature of the globe. You literally could see the way the horizon curved, because all there was gold sand and blue sky. And then in the Atlas Mountains, we're in these incredible high, jagged mountains with valleys filled with agriculture and tall poplar trees, you know, fields of crops, people bringing down fuel for the winter, lots and lots of goat herds. So it was extremely varied. But I think my favorite landscape, and it's just a personal thing, is if you like the very, very wide river valleys So you'll have a huge river valley, which might be a kilometre across, of gold, silver, and the blue, blue sky.
Who were you with?
I had with me three Amazigh Berber guides and six camels. The camels, my favourite, and the leader was called Hamish. And of the three guides, two stayed with me for the whole 7.5 months. And that was Addi, who at 23 was very young when he started out. And it's the son of a nomad. He was brought up in a tent, illiterate, and actually didn't speak Arabic, only spoke Tashlahit, his own language, because he'd never been to school. And then Brahim, who was probably in his 40s, and he was the son of a shepherd, but he was a very experienced expeditioner. And he's also a Hafidh al-Quran, which means he'd learned the Quran off by heart. And actually, one of the beautiful things about the whole voyage is that every single morning I was woken up to the sound of him singing the prayers. And he had a very, very beautiful voice.
I love that. That makes me think, I mean, very different, but of all the time I've spent in Istanbul and getting woken up by the call to prayer, which is very different when it's blasting from speakers across a loud city. But I imagine the impact is somewhat the same. You know, we've been talking about slow travel and walking. And I think, you know, to me, as someone who's from the UK, it's very easy to romanticize that. But it also can be just a necessary means of getting from one place to another, especially if you're living a nomadic lifestyle. What did they think of you and what you were setting out to do?
Well, I suspect they thought I was off my rocker, to be honest, when I first started, but I soon became one of the team. I think I learned so much from them because, as you say, it's very easy to romanticize this lifestyle, but actually it's extremely difficult and harsh. It's very beautiful. The family ties are unbelievable. And the simplicity, the living with nature, living with your animals, the sheer kind of beauty of what you see and experience every day is, you know, is something that really touched my soul. But I also recognize that, you know, when you're sick, there are no doctors. When you're cold, you're in a tent every single night and it gets to below zero. So you're very, very cold. If your teeth go bad, there's no dentist. So I think, as you say, it's very easy to romanticize, but what I tried to do was take all the good things, the simplicity, the generosity, the hospitality, and that kind of feeling of being really bonded with the earth, with Mother Earth, and then also to enjoy modern dentistry.
How many miles were you covering each day? And it must have got harder with less food.
The mileage was, it depended on what leg we were on, and we were always going at the pace of camels because the camels were carrying all our food and our water. Water was the most important part of everything. And so in the Sahara, we walked fast because it was flat, and we walked for 5 hours a day and at 5 kilometers an hour. And that is basically, that's camel pace, because the most important things were to keep the camels in good health, because they were carrying all our food and, most importantly, all our water. We did roughly 25 kilometers a day on the Sahara leg and between, I'd say, 18 and 25 on the other legs.
I wanted to know more about the dynamics between Alice and her guides and how it changed throughout their journey. In a minute, on any long journey, rituals help to pass the time, whether it's games or even sing-alongs.
From Foreign Policy, I'm Rina Ninen, the host of The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women. Over the past few years, we've looked at how women around the world are changing societal norms to increase their economic power. This season, we're focusing completely on girls, how they're pushing for a brighter, more powerful future, and what the rest of us can do to set them up for success. Join us for stories about girl power, young women who are fighting for change, to give themselves a chance to live a life of their own choosing. That's season 6 of The Hidden Economics of Remarkable Women, wherever you get your podcasts.
Have you ever owned something that inspired you to level up? For me, it's my hiking boots, which have gotten me over some pretty tough terrain. And I'm not talking about my morning commute on the New York City subway. They've pushed me to go to far-off places like trekking in the remote mountains in Patagonia, wildlife spotting amid the thick rainforests of the Amazon, and climbing through canyons in the Utah desert. When we own exceptional things, they inspire us to do exceptional things. The all-new Lexus GX has an exceptional capability that will have you seeing possibilities you never knew existed. There's an available panorama glass roof, 33-inch all-terrain tyres, and multi-terrain select driving modes. Its advanced technology and luxurious interior means that wherever you go, you'll never go without. Live up to the all-new Lexus GX. Luxury beyond limits. Experience amazing at your Lexus dealer.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
Tell me a little bit about, I guess, like the daily routine. You know, everyone has to kind of like pull their weight, right? So I'm sure there were chores that you had to do. Someone was taking care of the camels. How did you divvy up all the responsibilities and how did you work together?
I decided from very early on that I didn't want to be like a client or a guest. I wanted to be one of the team. So from the very first day, I helped unload the camels, put the tents up, do all those kind of, you know, chores that we all needed to do. But we did have separate responsibilities. So one of the Brahims was a cook. Adzi's job was to help the camels and to make the bread. And Brahim's job was to oversee the camels and to set our directions of travel. And my job was to help with everything. And also I demanded that I be allowed to do the dishes. Now, this sounds like a strange thing, but it was a job that I could do. And nobody in any culture in the whole universe likes doing the dishes. So the men were actually really grateful because it meant that after every single meal, I was there scrubbing away at the pots and pans. And bear in mind that especially on the Sahara leg, we only had perhaps the equivalent of a mug of water to wash dishes for soup, a casserole for four people. So it was a really mucky, horrible job.
So tell me a little bit more about the camels and their personalities.
I'm going to tell you about Hamish first, because he was my favourite. He used to come and sit by my tent. And it was quite nice, actually. Sometimes when you're feeling a bit down, it's very nice to have a big hairy camel kind of slobbering all over you. I would recommend it. So Hamish was, they were all male camels. And one of the things you need to know about them is they were all on heat for two of the legs of the journeys. And when male camels are on heat, they do lots of things. If they smell a female camel, and they can smell a female camel from a kilometre away, they spread their legs, pee, and whip the pee up onto their backs with their tails acting like helicopters.
Oh my God. I mean, like, honestly, I think I've seen that in, like, central London before, but, you know.
Very similar. And then the other thing they do is they blow this, they've got a big pink flap of skin inside their mouths that looks that they blow out of their mouths and fill it with saliva. And it's like a big, huge bubblegum ball the size of a football. The problem with that is all the saliva falls on you when you're at their front leading them. So we would be covered in camel spit for large quantities of time. But Hamish was a bit of a card. He would always be on the lookout for the ladies. And he would do things like he'd wait until Brahim wasn't looking and then sneak out behind him to find a lady love in the desert. So, yes, the camels were very entertaining. They all have their own personalities. Farquhar, for example, was a big softy and used to kind of gallop around the camp, kicking his legs up after we'd finished for the day. Hamish was naughty and used to bite people, including me, if he possibly could.
And but still your favourite.
Oh, he was absolutely. Who doesn't love a bad boy? Come on.
Here's Alice reading from Travelling with Nomads, about Hector the camel having a sore foot.
Hector has a blister. He's limping and keeps falling behind. We tried to limit his pain by unloading some of the heavy stuff and redistributing it, and also by choosing to walk where there are as few stones as possible. This means our route is even more meandering than usual. It's a real problem. We need all six camels as we are entering further into a no-water zone and are heading west and south, far from any tarmac and possible water trucks. The men confer after lunch and decide to operate. Brahim goes and brings Hector in from his grazing and couches him. Ishu ties a rope around his left foreleg, where the sore is, over his thigh and shin to keep the leg bent. He then passes the rope over Hector's back. Now, both legs are immobilized with his sore pad exposed. By this time, Hector knows something bad is up and starts booming quietly and looking at us with questioning eyes. Brahim is squatting directly in front of him at his head, with his hand holding firmly onto the halter close to his mouth, bringing his head low to the sand. Ishu and Adi are busy at the fire. They're heating up the hoe head and two iron tent pegs until they are as red hot as the embers. They've also spread out a chunk of yellowish-white animal fat left over from our meat supplies. They press a palm-sized gobbet of the fat deeply into the hole in Hector's pad. The bad bit is about to start, and Brahim takes hold of Hector's bottom lip. Hector lets out a roar of pain. Smoke from the fat and the smell of burning flesh fill the air. Ishu presses again and again, going back to the fire to get the heated pegs and laying these flat against the fat. Hector is being so good. He cries, but he doesn't thrash until the very end. Suddenly, he obviously can't take anymore and lashes out violently with his back legs. Ishu and Adi jump out of the way. A kick would snap their bones like a twig. The aim has been to use the fat and the heat to cauterize and seal the wound. By pressing deep into the flesh, it will burn away the damaged tissue and harden it so that the wound doesn't continue to deepen and split Hector's pad. Ishu unties him and Brahim lets go of his bottom lip and takes off his halter. Meanwhile, Adi has laid out a feast of oats on a tarpaulin under a tree for shade. Hector surges to his feet and Adi guides him over to the treat. He munches away, and when I look over half an hour later, he has couched himself beside the tarpaulin and is still looking a bit sorry for himself.
An experience like that must really bond you as a group. How did your relationships change over the journey? What was the arc? Because, you know, from what I understand, there are very few women guides in Morocco. So what was that dynamic like between you and all of the men at the beginning, and how did it change?
What happened was, as we went through our different adventures and got to know each other and got to spend every night together and walked for hours talking to each other and got to learn about each other's cultures and what we thought. And also, don't forget, you know, in these pressurized situations or even just long situations, your true self comes out. So you can't hide behind any kind of artifice. And I think that's how you bond with people. It's by showing your authentic self, your vulnerable self, your, you know, when your tummy's bad and you have to run miles out of camp because you've got diarrhea and everyone else is laughing at you because, of course, it's funny. I mean, that's what bonds you. It's all the small things. And knowing, I think when you start from a base of affection and respect, and I felt immense respect for these men from the very beginning, for their talents and for the way they guided me safely and all of us, you know, safely through this insane journey, 7.5 months on foot through some of the most hostile environments in the world, including 10 days through landmines. And we made it. So I felt so much respect for them. And I think they felt that. And then they were able to give me respect back. We sang as we walked.
What did you sing? Wait, this is... Well, you really did get close if you were all singing together.
We were. I mean, I don't really want to sing for you because I think people might switch off in their droves. But there's kind of a walking song, which is Allah, Allah, Ya Mama. Assalamu alaikum, Ya Mama. And you repeat it and there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of verses. So we sang that a lot as we walked.
Was there any sort of natural dangers I mean,
yes.
You know, you mentioned Indiana Jones. I'm like, was there like quicksand or, you know, how is the desert dangerous?
The desert's dangerous. One day we were walking along in our usual formation, which was Lahu and Addy at the front with their camels. Callum is their lead camel. And then me and Brahim behind with Hamish as our lead camel. We were talking about football. Moroccans are crazy about football. So Brahim and I are chatting about football. And suddenly there was the most horrific scream from Callum, the lead camel. And he had sunk up to his chest in quicksand with no warning. And because the camels are tied together in a camel train, he was pulling down Alistair, who was behind him. He was pulling him down into the sand. So it was like a car crash, you know, when like within a split second, you change from complete serenity to an experience that could lead to death. Addy is very young and very strong. And the only reason that Callum didn't drown in the quicksand, because what happens is if you hit the water underneath the sand, you go down and you drown, you would literally drown in sand, is that Addy managed to yank him up, yank his neck up and push him out of the sand. And then there's all this screaming and the camels are bellowing. And we were so lucky to escape because it went on a bit longer. Our other camels got trapped, but we managed to get them out and we managed to get to safety. And that was probably our closest actual experience with something that could have been catastrophic. One of the things that I write about in my book is about climate change, because I walked for 7.5 months and I had 1 week of rain, 3 days of rain. So we're suffering from a drought in Morocco, have done since 2014, really. And, you know, seeing that kind of climate change is quite devastating. The Sahara is dried up. It can't sustain life. That's why when you see all these boat people, refugees coming over to Europe, to Britain, a lot of them are coming from the Sahel. And the reason they're coming is the land has completely dried out. And the reason the land has dried out is because of our actions towards climate change. And it's not really because of their actions. So it's very difficult when you suddenly feel this global responsibility for the way you've been living and you see what effect it has on the land that you travel through.
Next up, while Alice forged great friendships with her Berber companions, she also talks extensively of the memorable chats with women she met along their route.
Are you ever minding your own business when you start to wonder, how do killer whales work? Who are Hollywood's paparazzi? Did British sailors get it on in the 1800s with each other? I'm Jonathan Van Ness, and every week on Getting Curious, I sit down for a gorgeous conversation with a brilliant expert to learn all about something that makes me curious. Honey, we explore everything around here with scientists, historians, activists, entertainers, and other brilliant guest experts. You can join me every Wednesday for an all-new topic with an all-new expert on Getting Curious. Listen to Getting Curious wherever you get your podcasts.
One of the wonderful things about these travels was, you know, I was going across very, very remote territory, very underpopulated territory. So the people we met were absolutely very rural people. They were either subsistence farmers or they were goat herders, or in the Sahara, they were camel herders. And to a man and woman, they were the most hospitable people I have ever encountered. Even when they were very poor and you could tell that they didn't have much for themselves, they would bring out their very best for us. They'd always bring out fresh bread, camel milk or goat's milk, and sometimes this very delicious soured goat's milk, which is called agro, which is absolutely marvelous.
What was the most sort of memorable meal or evening you shared with some people who hosted you?
Well, one night we were camped outside a desert city in the Sahara. And we were camped in a kind of because we couldn't go into cities with the camels. And I say city, but I mean town, really. And all of the notable people of the city came out to greet us. So all the kind of the judge and the governor and the mayor and the head of police. And they all arrived to have dinner with us in our kind of little hollow in the sand with all the camels couched around us in our tents. And they brought with them a feast. And in the Sahara, they eat rice. That's their main dish. So it was rice with camel meat. And they brought everything with them. They bought tea and dates and fruit and Fanta. And then we sat around talking about politics and poetry.
Dini.
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 Dini. Chinita hamuds, soft squished dates. What? Al-khubz?
Khubz.
Arum tadun. Which is beautiful fresh baked bread with fat. Doesn't sound nice, but fat from goat inside it with spices. And this is our host, Ahmed. Ahlan ya Ahmed.
It seems like you had a lot of encounters with the men who lived there, but were you crossing paths with the women much too?
Well, this is the wonderful thing that this is my superpower, actually, because I'm exploring and adventuring in the Middle East and Africa, usually in very traditional communities. And as a woman, I get to meet the other women. And it's really something that men cannot do, because in these communities, a man cannot mingle with women who are not from his family at all. So when we would approach a nomad's tent, for example, in the Sahara, Lahu would say to me, Zahra, they call me Zahra, 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 get to the front. You're the key. Because I had to approach the tents, because the women would be in the tents, the men would be out with the camels. And women would be very frightened if men arrived at their tent, you know, alone. And also, I mean, one time I was actually sitting in the tent having a very nice cup, a glass of tea with these Sahrawi women. And the men were outside also having tea, but outside. And a husband arrived running with a huge stick ready to beat the guys because he thought that they had, you know, come into his women's tent. So I did meet all the women. And I think that was one of the great privileges that I had, was to be able to speak to them about their lives. And these are not voices that you hear very often. And then I remember another encounter, and this was, if you like, completely the opposite. And it was with, we were walking again in the middle of Sahara. So we're walking through sand. And suddenly, you know, out of nowhere, a beautiful, gorgeous young woman appears in her bright colored milfa. And that's the robe that the Saharan women wear, which is usually brightly colored tie-dye. And it's a bit like a sari, except it covers all of you and it also goes over your head. So this woman kind of fluttered out of the sands and invited us for tea. And she told me that she spoke English, Arabic, Hassaniya, and Italian. She had studied in the nearby city of Leyoun, and she was just back in the desert with her grandfather. She said, oh, you know, my granddad, he likes to keep the traditional life. He's really old, but he's got some goats and some camels. So we come out at the weekend to keep him company. She said, but it's so boring for us. She said, there's no internet. You know, none of my friends are here. I can't go for coffee anywhere. And I just thought, how funny that this is the person that I meet in the middle of this wilderness.
You know, we're talking about the relationship with, you know, your fellow travellers. How did your relationship with yourself change? You must have, you know, when I've done long hiking trips over, I mean, nothing compared to this, the course of a few days. You have a lot of time just in your own thoughts. How did the relationship with yourself evolve?
I think I like myself more when I'm doing something like that than I do when I'm sitting at home on the couch with the cats watching Netflix. So I think when you're in the midst of an endeavor and you have a very clear set of goals, I think you're allowed to like yourself more and to enjoy your life more. At least that's what I find. So I liked myself better.
I feel like I, even when I'm sort of really, when it's sort of a low point of a journey, whether it is having a horrible stomach upset and trying to run and find a toilet, or I'm tired or I'm hungry and I'm cranky, somehow I always feel like I'm the best version of myself when I'm traveling. And I don't know if that is actually said something. Maybe I've got issues with my regular life and I'm trying to escape something. But it sounds like maybe you're the same.
I'm exactly the same, and you've put it perfectly. So I think one of the things about slow travel and traveling slowly is it does give you a lot of time to, you know, allow your inner voice and your inner thoughts room to just be. And as you sit within those thoughts and within those feelings, you feel very much connected to yourself, to the things around you, to the people around you, because you're not distracted all the time and you're not distracting yourself. I think in modern life, certainly what I do is I distract myself. You know, I think, oh, I know, I'll just have 10 minutes on Instagram Reels just to kind of quieten the voices. But when you're traveling, when you're walking, when you're experiencing new things, you don't have those voices to quieten because you're just doing things and you're living and you're being. And I find that is one of the most enriching things and why I really would encourage slow travel. It gives you the space and the time to just be and to feel the good things, to feel the bad things, because they're all going to pass. The good things will pass, the bad things will pass, but you're continuing on this journey. And for me, it's a massive metaphor. It's not even a metaphor. It is life. That is what we're doing. None of what we're doing in the end will matter. It just is about going through the journey. So try and be in the journey. Try and be aware of it. Try and look around you. Try and be good to all the people around you. Be good to yourself, but be in the journey, good and bad.
How was the end of the journey? How were you all greeted at the end?
Oh, the end was so lovely. So I'm sure a lot of people will understand this. Even after a holiday, even after a weekend away, you go through a process of mourning, don't you?
Oh my God, like, yes. Every time.
I know, and it's dreadful. Well, imagine after 7.5 months, I was absolutely dreading it because, of course, you know, the group was going to break up. The men were going to go their separate ways. The camels were going back to their summer pastures. And I was going to be, you know, back being my kind of normal, in inverted commas, self. So I had a lot of sorrow building up about the end of this adventure. I was exhausted also, absolutely. All my reserves had been drained, but I had this deep underlying, sadness. Then we got into Ouarzazate, which is the desert, it's just the gateway to the desert in Morocco. We were met by a band of Amazigh singers and dancers. Everyone from the village came out and we arrived at 5 o'clock, just at the golden hour. And of course, the camels kick up lots of dust. So you had this kind of golden haze around the camels and the sound of the drumming and all the children capering and doing handstands and the women ululating. It was an absolutely wonderful end to the adventure.
Next week, Guatemalan American food historian Sandra Gutierrez on shopping in markets all over Latin America and how the cuisines of 21 countries influence the world. I'm Lale Arakoglu, and you can find me on Instagram at Lale Hannah. Our engineers are Jake Loomis and Gabe Quiroga. The show's mixed by Amar Lal. Jude Kampfner from Corporation for Independent Media is our producer. See you next week.
Hey, it's Chris Klemek here. If you like this show, you might enjoy There's More to That. It's a new podcast from Smithsonian Magazine and PRX where I'll be talking to journalists around the globe, taking inspiration from the Smithsonian Institution's museums and research centers and using insightful reporting to explore the mysteries of the wider world. Plus, every episode comes with at least one conveniently packaged fact for you to share at your next dinner party. So check us out. Subscribe to There's More to That from Smithsonian Magazine and PRX. And find out how much more there is to almost everything.
I'm Tanya Mosley.
In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.
From PRX.